Current state on 90.5 WKAR. Before the hour is through, MSU President Emeritus Clifton Wharton Jr. President Wharton and I had a nice chat recently, and we'll re-air that for you. He has his autobiography has just come out recently. A fascinating career and a fascinating guy. Musician Chris Thiele, who will be in Kalamazoo here in just a couple of days. And lots more before the hour is through here on WKAR's Current State. Glad you're along. Residents of Lansing's East Side are assessing their choices for next Tuesday's city council election. They will choose between challenger Shelley Davis Milock and the first ward incumbent who joins us now. Jody Washington was first elected to city council 4 years ago. She has said her biggest political accomplishment so far has been to unite what she has described as a fractured first ward. She's described her top priorities in order: public safety, roads and infrastructure, and economic development. Interestingly, Washington's son Adam Hussein is also a candidate for city council in Lansing's third ward. Recently, mother and son have both been targets of a dark money organization, Capital Region Progress. Jody Washington, welcome back to Current State.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
One term wasn't enough.
No.
You just take a licking and keep on ticking. Is that it? Why do you want back on the city council?
I want back on city council because in the first ward, we have made tremendous strides in the past 4 years. And it's not, and I take credit for an awful lot of that, for being able to unite neighborhoods, different levels of government. I meet privately with the developers and business owners, and I put an awful lot of work into it. We've come a long way in 4 years, and I would like 4 more years to have it go even further.
You've identified public safety as your top priority, and it was about a year ago the website Law Street Media digested all the latest FBI crime statistics and found Lansing was the 8th most violent city in the country among cities with a population under 200,000, and we want to clarify that it also found out that the city's murder rate was down significantly. So it was this mixed bag of data. We cracked the top 10, but murder was down at the same time. What's your take on violent crime and the prevention of violent crime in Lansing?
Well, I think that we could tackle this on so many levels, but I do have to believe that violent crime is up. I will tell you, even at the beginning of this summer, I was leaving my mother's home. She lives in the southwest side of Lansing, and a young man had the nerve to open my car door and tell me, "I'm not the one. I will beat you down." So I have to believe if it's happening to me, it's happening to other people. So I would say it's multifaceted. We have to make sure that we have all of our police officers filled and funded. We have to have the boots on the ground. It's not good enough to have the data that when people call in that we show hot spots, because we have cultures where people don't call the police. We have a lot of refugees that come from countries where police are not trusted, and they don't know the language here. And I think we have to work with our youth. We have to work with our police department, and we have to work with our schools closely to put a lid on this. And, of course, the proliferation of heroin and other drug issues isn't helping.
Does something really profound need to change regarding public safety? Or do you think all the pieces are in place to do this well? What do you think of the job Chief Yankowski is doing?
Oh, I think he does a phenomenal job.
Okay.
I really do.
Okay.
With the tools that he has, I think he does a phenomenal job. And I think we have a phenomenal police force. I think we need more police officers. Technology is great, but it will never replace seeing the police officer on the street.
How does that happen? How do we get more police on the street?
Well, we will have to fund them, but I think we also need to have more community police officers that are specific to specific neighborhoods. Chief Yankowski is real big on that. And I know in the neighborhoods where I have had effective CPOs, it has done a tremendous amount of good. We have one in the Northtown neighborhood. We've had them in the Baker Denora neighborhood, Kalamazoo corridor. And it really does make a profound difference because the people get used to seeing that officer. Mm-hmm. They trust that officer, and they're more apt to go to that officer.
One of the most memorable stories I ever did here at WKAR was really getting to know the community police officer, and I'm going to blank on his name because it was a few years ago, but it was in the Walnut neighborhood. And I mean, there is a challenged neighborhood, one that's undergone a lot of changes over the years, and just getting to know this guy and learning about his relationship with everybody who lived in the Walnut neighborhood, it's arguably, I think, a very good thing.
I do too.
Your son Adam Hussein, who is a candidate in the 3rd Ward, was on the program last week, and he complained that there are just too many liquor stores, too many marijuana dispensaries in that ward. Are there too many of those businesses on the northeast side?
There are beginning to be, yes. I notice every day there are more marijuana shops popping up. Now, understand, I'm not necessarily against dispensaries, but I want them to be done legally and responsibly. And I think to just pop one up every other day is not legal, nor is it responsible. We have an ordinance in place. The ordinance needs to be followed. These places need to be licensed, audited, inspected. We need to make sure that our product is safe for the patients that need the product. But to have them just popping up anywhere at any time is too much, and they are beginning to overrun the city again.
But does the Lansing police have the resources to really address this issue and to keep it from getting worse?
No. And I will say why. Because I believe we have an administration that has turned a blind eye to the proliferation of the marijuana shops. And if you don't have the support of the administration, what are the police officers to do? Why would you go in there and constantly raid these places if nobody's going to send it to the prosecutor? Their time and efforts are better spent somewhere else.
Now, does that approach have support elsewhere on the council? You said the administration. Is the mayor and the administration likes that approach? Mm-hmm. Does your
council would
there
like the ordinance to be followed?
Okay. We're talking with Jody Washington, who is a 1st Ward candidate, the incumbent in the 1st Ward, a candidate for Lansing City Council. A dark money organization, Capital Region Progress, is stirring the pot in this election with mailers and attack ads against you and Adam Hussein, your son and 3rd Ward candidate. What do you think the impact has been of this?
For me, I don't think there's been any impact. I think there's been quite an impact in the 3rd Ward, and I think they overplayed their hand and it actually backfired on them.
How so? What do you mean by that?
People
exactly?
are tired of this. People are tired of this manipulation and inferring that people are stupid and would fall for this kind of nonsense. Let me tell you, Mark, this is exactly why I didn't seek the chamber endorsement this year. And I wrote them in my letter stating that my head was still reeling from these tactics from 4 years ago and 2 years ago, and that until I saw something different, I would not be seeking their endorsement. And although they say they are not a part of this dark money, in 2011, I do believe the chamber said that although they are not a part of it, it is a means for their members to contribute to this type of activity. Mm. I find that reprehensible. This is tearing at the very fabric of our community, and I think it makes an absolute mockery of our democratic process in this city.
You suggested in an interview last week that you were close to learning the identities of a few individuals
yes.
in Capital Region Progress.
Yes.
Have you gotten anywhere with that?
I will actually have these conversations with these individuals after the election, and I will tell you, Mark.
You've learned of people in Capital
yes.
Region Progress.
Who are funneling money. To this. And understand, too, that Capital Region Progress also, this EPIC group is also part of that.
Yeah.
And they go through all these different names.
This is the place apparently with an office on Lake Lansing
correct.
Road.
Correct. And it's an empty building. Apparently,
right.
Capital Region Progress had been kicked out of there a few months ago, but they use it for mailing, and now they call it EPIC. I mean, this is just an absolute disgrace to our community.
Are you prepared to identify the people who were contributing to this?
No.
Okay.
No.
Are you prepared to say whether Mayor Bernero is directly involved?
I will tell you that business owners have said that he has asked them to please fund this organization. He will tell you that he is not involved in it, and he's absolutely right. He's not. He has other people fund it.
What are you going to do with – you're going to have conversations with people who are contributing to
yes,
Capital
I will.
Region Progress. Where do you think this is going to go?
You know, I'm hoping at some point that some people will develop a moral compass and that they will stand up and say, I'm tired of being bullied. I'm tired of contributing to this. Let's move this region forward. Mark, this does nothing for our region.
People are being bullied to contribute
absolutely.
To capital region progress?
Absolutely. Absolutely. People are bullied in this community to do a lot of things. And like I said, it doesn't move us forward. We need to work regionally, but when you have groups and people funneling money and people bullying and attacking individuals and attacking groups, I mean, for crying out loud, Deb Nolan got attacked. She's a county commissioner. 4 years ago, we had Derek Quinney, Carol Wood, Brian Jeffries. It does nothing to move us forward because when these people are elected, some of them are not going to be able to just put it aside. And Does that help regionalism? Does that help the business community? Does that help us move forward? I don't think it does. Mm. Let's start acting like a world-class city, like we want to call ourselves.
You alluded to the city's heroin challenges here.
Yes.
We are contending with a surge in heroin-related deaths and overdoses this year, and Chief Yankowski at one point went so far as to call it an epidemic. I think he might have walked back that epidemic comment. If I remember correctly, but I mean, about 4 weeks ago, there were, according to LPD, five people who were stricken by heroin overdoses the same day, mind you. I believe it was Friday, the 25th of September. Two of these suspected heroin overdose victims died. What role does city government play in improving this situation, and what should be done?
Well, Mark, most people that know me know that I have a brother that died of a heroin overdose 10 years ago.
I did not know that. I'm sorry to hear that.
So this is deeply personal, and it can affect any family, any socioeconomic group, and it tears the entire family apart. And when it tears the family apart, it tears the community apart. And as a city, I'm not sure there is a whole lot we can do. We can perhaps do a needle exchange program because, as I said, my brother, he died of a heroin overdose, but he also had hepatitis C from dirty needles. He would have eventually died of that. I think we need to collaborate multi-level, city, county, state. The city can't do anything on its own. I would like to see, however, that if addicts do come forward and ask for help, that they not be treated as criminals. That they're a victim. They're a victim of people that are trying to make a profit. Doctors who are overprescribing opiates, drug dealers that are just trying to make a living. I view them as victims. And I think it's actually a state issue. And I read yesterday where Governor Snyder is coming up with some initiatives to deal with the heroin epidemic, and I will call it an epidemic. Mm. It's out of control, and it's something we need to fund. We need to deal with the cultural issues that these people are wrapped up in. I mean, you have to remember their friends, their entire culture is wrapped into the heroin. There are so many levels to this issue that need to be addressed.
Let's change gears here. We don't have much time left. What would be your number one action item right now with regard to the Board of Water and Light? I mean, we've seen all kinds of changes there. What else? When you think of the Lansing Board of Water and Light, what issue do you think of first that requires more action?
Well, Vince Delgado and I led the charge on trying to fund an independent operational audit of the Board of Water and Light, which I thought would have been a really good idea. People were asking for it. The mayor had asked for an inspector general. We felt an independent audit. Monday night, that pretty much got derailed, and the money will be going elsewhere. So I think we just need to keep a really close look as a council and the administration on what is going on operationally with the Board of Water and Light. But, Mark, I'm going to be really frank, I think they're doing a really good job. And I think they've done everything we've asked them to do, and we just need to keep a close eye.
We want to point out to our listeners that five of the six Lansing City Council candidates have been interviewed now on Current State. Interviews with Emily Devendorf, Patricia Spitzley, Carol Wood, Harold Lehman Jr., Adam Hussein, and Shelley Davis Milock all can be found online at WKAR.org. Please follow the links to Current State. Incumbent Aileen Bowles has declined Current State's repeated requests for an interview, saying her schedule does not allow enough time. We want to thank Jody Washington and wish you luck next Tuesday.
Thank you so much.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. In our increasingly high-tech world, it seems there's still a handful of timeless passions from the good old days that captivate Americans. Here's our short list: baseball, fireworks, and trains. How many of us have played with model trains as kids or collected them as adults? Those who truly love railroad lore relish the smallest details, even things many others never notice. The Lansing Model Railroad Club understands that feeling. That's why the group's trying to save an old, nearly forgotten building. Current state's Kevin Lavery is here now with more. Kevin, what's the club planning to do exactly?
Mark, the club is buying what's called the Michigan Avenue Tower, and to call it a tower is really being generous. It's only about 20 or 25 feet tall or so. It sits in a really popular spot, though. It's near the corner of Grand River and Turner Street, right there in the heart of Lansing's old town. If Lansing had a Times Square, I suppose that's probably it. It's easy to miss, though. I mean, the shack here, the tower, is not Grand Central Station. In fact, when I came there to talk to Michael Frizzell, the president of the Lansing Model Railroad Club, I didn't even notice I had driven right past it.
Oh, there's a crazy little shack beyond the tracks.
A lot of people don't really recognize this building. A lot of people are looking at a lot of the other attractions that have developed in Old Town, which is a real nice area. But one day I was going through Old Town and I happened to think about the old MA or Michigan Avenue Tower, and I started looking at it and I go, wow, the building's in disrepair. I see some windows open, one broken up on the second level. One of the doors downstairs is boarded up and along with another window. So the thought hit me about, hey, our club could use this building and we have the resources to be able to restore it.
This is a very small building, two stories. I'm going to guess it's about 25 feet high. It's not very large at all. What were towers like this used for and when?
This tower used to be located on Michigan Avenue, right next to Clara's Restaurant today. It used to control the junction between the Pier Marquette, later on the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad, and the Michigan Central Railroad, later Conrail. We suspect it's been there for around 100 years. It was decommissioned in 1986 and moved to Old Town that same year.
So that gives me a general time period. Late 19th century, these were standard operating equipment on railroads.
Right. Today, when you look at railroad operations, a lot of things are now centrally located at dispatch centers in various cities, like on CSX, they control it out of Calumet City, Illinois. Norfolk Southern controls their tracks out of Dearborn. So you needed these towers along the way, either connected by telephone or even earlier by telegraph, to allow trains to move into a certain section of track. And you had a person stationed there continuously to watch over that track. And I should also note that crossing, since it was over at Michigan Avenue, controlled the crossing gates there. I've had members in my club, some of our old timers, say there was an air actuated pump in there that they could control the gates. Later on, that was replaced by automation.
Okay, so it was electric, but not in the sense we have today. There was a human being stationed in this building to be sure that the connections were happening so the trains wouldn't collide.
That's correct. And that person that was in the tower, he would be in constant communication with the chief dispatcher located somewhere on the railroad. They had a phone system in there, or even later on a radio system where he could even talk to the trains and say it was okay to come through there. We even have records that we just found in this tower that was from 1985, where the person in the tower logged all the train movements that came through. So we have engine numbers, caboose numbers, and time and everything on this sheet of paper from Conrail.
When this structure was moved here in 1986, what became of it? Was it actively used by another railroad club?
Well, there was an organization called the North Lansing Electric Railway Museum that started, and they had ambitious plans to run electric streetcars from Old Town to Lansing, as the best I can find information on. They actually had some old interurban rail cars from the South Shore Railroad in Indiana, brought them up here. And I really don't know what happened with them. I suspect money was probably a problem. And like with a lot of organizations, they probably had a handful of volunteers, and people just tend to go on and leave the organization. And it soon became defunct. And the tower has since here sat with nobody taking care of it or doing anything with it.
We're talking with Michael Frizzell, the president of the Lansing Model Railroad Club, about the MA Tower, the Michigan Avenue Tower, which is no longer on Michigan Avenue and hasn't been for decades. It's a building that was once used in the days before automation to control the flow of train traffic. Why is it worth saving?
There aren't very many towers like this in existence throughout the United States. In fact, this is the only tower in the Lansing area that's still around. There used to be actually a North Lansing tower that looked similar to this one. That was torn down. There was one over in the East Lansing area at the junction called Trowbridge. Everybody knows Trowbridge Road, but there was a tower there. And I believe there were some towers on Washington Avenue. They're all gone. And so we think it's worth saving, and it's important for us to explain railroad history to the public that comes to our depot.
And you feel that with one small building in a large apparatus of a railroad system, that this building can tell a story?
It definitely will tell a story, because we're going to do it. What we're going to do when we move this tower to our club is we're going to restore this tower. We're going to modernize it a little bit. We're going to actually add a computer in there. We're going to add communications lines from the tower to our depot. And inside our depot is a model railroad layout. And what we're going to do is put the dispatcher in this tower so he can control the trains from the tower and give us orders to run our trains similar to what it did in its days of use. So we're going to put it to use again. It's not just going to sit there as a statue. We want somebody in there to use it, and then the public can go in and take a look at it. We're also, we've gotten some donations of some real life wayside signals, and we're going to set those up on our club property and control them from the tower.
And of course, in the 21st century, the way you fix a 19th century building is to go online, isn't it?
It is, and this is the first time we're using the GoFundMe. We created the MA Tower Preservation Project on GoFundMe to help us raise funds to help move the structure and also restore the structure at our facility. Our primary means of funding for our club has been our train show that we hold every year in November, and we've got it coming up on November 15th. But we're gonna need more funds to dedicate towards this building.
How much are we talking about?
We have set a goal of $35,000 for the GoFundMe account. And that's going to cover everything from putting a concrete foundation, concrete work isn't cheap, to paying a mover to move this structure, and running electrical there, and then doing the siding. The building needs a new roof on it, windows. So you can see that cost is adding up very quickly.
So, Michael, what is now the timetable for moving the Michigan Avenue Tower into Delta Township?
Our goal is to move this tower in 2016, which is next year, obviously. We hope to get a pad poured for the site in the springtime. So it's an active goal. So, again, we really want to push people to help donate to our cause.
And so it sounds like this thing is going to go from eyesore to showpiece in about a year's time.
We really hope so. I think people will be amazed at the work we can do. And just to show what the work we have done, just take a look at our Millet Depot. We've taken care of over 100-year-old depot all these years. We paint it, we keep it up, we've expanded it, and we still preserve the integrity of the building.
Michael Frizzell is the president of the Lansing Model Railroad Club. We've been talking about the old Michigan Avenue Tower, which by its name, once sat on Michigan Avenue, right next to the Lansing Train Depot, which is now Clara's Restaurant. It has been here in Old Town Lansing for about 30 years, and it is going to Delta Township, hopefully within the next year. Michael, thanks so much for explaining some of this train lore here in Lansing.
Thank you very much for having me today. I really appreciate it.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And coming up on Current State, Dr. Clifton, Clifton R. Wharton has lived a lifetime of firsts. Among them, he became the first African-American president of a major U.S. university. That was in 1970, here in East Lansing. Now he's published his memoirs in a new book. I'll talk with Dr. Wharton about his extraordinary life. Plus, mandolinist Chris Thiele performs in Kalamazoo Friday night. We'll talk with him about his music and his next big project, replacing Garrison Keillor next year on a Prairie Home Companion. That and more after the break. Stay with us. That's Vincent Bowens performing Song for My Songs on a Live Music Friday here on Current State back in February. Tomorrow, Current State on a Live Music Friday welcomes Eric Smith. He's studying piano at Michigan State's Jazz Studies program. He's got a new EP out. He'll be joined by three other music students who also play on the release with him. Eric Smith, our Live Music Friday guest tomorrow. Hope you can join us. It's Current State on WKAR from 1970 to 1978. Our next guest served as president of Michigan State University. Clifton R. Wharton Jr.'s arrival in East Lansing made him the first African-American president of a major U.S. university, but it was only one memorable stop amid an eventful career of firsts. After MSU, Dr. Wharton became the first black CEO of a Fortune 500 company, TIAA Cref. Now, Dr. Wharton's written an account of his eventful career, Privilege and Prejudice, The Life of a Black Pioneer. It recounts all the chapters of Wharton's life from his unique perspective as a child of privilege who nevertheless faced racial discrimination. I first asked Dr. Wharton if there was a period during his 89 years when he felt especially discriminated against.
Well, I think that's a little difficult to respond to because during the time when I came, after I came back to the United States when I was a youngster, it was something that was there fairly quite frequently all the way through and most of my time and most of my life.
Race is still an extremely relevant topic in this country, often painfully relevant. In the aftermath of Ferguson and the Charleston massacre and other incidents, what do you make of the current atmosphere?
Well, if you would like me to do something like that, it would take about two or three books. But let me point out that my book is basically a personal history which covers a period well before Ferguson, okay? And it's an attempt to describe what the problems were that I encountered and how I overcame them and what was the nature of the discriminations or racism that I experienced. And the situation then was different than it is today. It's even different than it was for my father. For example, my father was the first black to pass the U.S. Foreign Service exam. Now, he did that in 1923. And at that time, when he did that, they had just created the Foreign Service Institute, which was the place where those who had passed the exam would be able to learn what it was like to be a diplomat. Now, my father, after he passed the exam, the State Department was flummoxed because they did not, it was segregated in Washington at that time, so they would not let him attend the Foreign Service Institute. That was discrimination. And so what they decided was, they said, we will give you your diploma that you have actually taken the course and sent you off to your first post. Now, that was discrimination in his day, okay? Each time, each generation, I believe, has experienced discrimination or racism at various times. My first exposure to racism was when I came back to the United States with my father from a post overseas. We had home leave, and my mother took me and had me go into a school, in a public school, for a period of time. Now, I had been tutored by my mother overseas with a correspondence course. And, of course, I had been taught by my mother to read very early when I was very young. And the teacher of my class realized that I could read extremely well, better than all the students in my class in the fourth grade. And so what happened was, whenever a student, another student in the class could not made a mistake reading, the teacher would call upon me, trying to make me feel at ease with my classmates, and ask me to correct the student and to read the words in turn I had read. So I did. Now, at the recess, when I went outside, the young man who I had corrected came up to me and he said, "You think you're very smart, but you're just an N-word." And I didn't know what that meant. Now, keep in mind that it was my first day at the public school in Boston. And before I had gone to school, my mother had said to me, "You may hear words which you've never heard before. And I don't want you to use those words until you come home and check them with me." And my mother reports that when I came home that first day, I had every profane word you could imagine. And she would say to me, "No, don't use that word. No, don't use that word." And I said to her, "What about the word screw?" And she said, "Do you mean like with wood?" I said, "I don't think so." She said, "Well, don't use that word either." And then I told her, there was a student there who called me a nigger. And I said, "What is that?" And my mother said, "Clifton," she said, "I want you to realize that that is the way in which other people sometimes will try to put you in a negative light, in a box. I want you to be proud of the fact that you are a Negro and proud of everything you are and who you are, but never let the person put you in that box of a negativism." That was my first exposure to racism. Mm.
You told Judy Woodruff on PBS that you are especially disturbed today by what you view as reduced opportunities for minorities to get a good education. What needs...
Well, absolutely, absolutely. What? And one of the things which disturbs me the most is that the situation, I believe, in certain cases, has become very extreme. One of the points that I frequently make is that there was a study which was done, and I quote from Britt Kerwin, who is one of my colleagues, the Chancellor of the University of Maryland, and he pointed out that if you are in the top quartile of income in the United States, your children have an 85% chance of going to college. If you are in the bottom quartile of income in the United States, your children have an 8% chance of going to college. Now, I think that that is an absolutely horrific problem in a loss of human capital. Those are individuals who could have the opportunity to go to college and be able to make a contribution to the United States, and they are being denied that by a whole host of forces and factors that are preventing them from being able to do that. There has been an increase in the rate of enrollment of minorities in the United States, but nothing like what it could be and should be in terms of just the national interest in the building of the national human capital. Never mind about the morality of it. It's really a horrific thing to have that happen to that segment of our society.
We are talking with MSU President Emeritus Clifton Wharton Jr., whose new memoir is titled Privilege and Prejudice, The Life of a Black Pioneer. Let's look on the brighter side for just a moment and ask you when in your life you felt most blessed. Is it possible to answer that question?
No, because in terms of the way I have proceeded, keep in mind, you see, one of the things that's very interesting is that in retrospect, I pioneered in a number of ways. For example, when I went to the School of Advanced International Studies to study for my master's degree, I was the first black at that school, and Washington was segregated in that time. Okay, so I knew that I was black, and I wanted to do very well in the school, and I did. But I was the very first. I can keep going in terms of stories. So when I went to Chicago, I was the first black to get a PhD in economics from the University of Chicago. Did the students think I was black? Yes, they knew it, but there was no particular problem at that particular time. But inevitably, there are instances where you run into racism, and every time that I have pioneered, it's attracted a great deal of attention. Now, it is true that before I got to Michigan State, people used to refer to me as the quiet pioneer because I did so much. But when I got to Michigan State, that hit the headlines all over the country because of the fact that I had become the first black president of a major white research university. And it was front page of the New York Times with all sorts of people. In fact, they filled the corridor of my office here in New York at the time with TV crews. There were about eight of them out lined up outside to interview me. And it was quite, so I was no longer quiet, a pioneer. By that time, it became very public.
I'd like to ask you to read an excerpt from the book. You have, of course, tremendous recollections of Michigan State. What are we about to hear?
Well, I thought that it might be interesting to hear what it was like when my wife and I made our first trip to Michigan State for the our first weekend when we came back to the campus for the Big Ten football game. It was a game against Indiana, and I'll read it from the book. Just before the kickoff, Dolores and I were greeted down onto the field after the band had finished its warm-up numbers. Quote, "Please give a Spartan welcome," boomed the announcer Tim Skubik, "to the next president of Michigan State University, Clifton R. Wharton Jr. and Mrs. Wharton." Holding hands, Dolores and I walked out the 50-yard line to the middle of the field, as 77,533 people stood up to cheer for us. The feeling is impossible to describe. MSU lost the game 16-0, but nothing could dampen our excitement of this absolutely memorable moment.
I have to assume that writing a comprehensive memoir like this one enables one to learn more about oneself. Did you learn more about yourself writing this?
Oh, absolutely. Indeed.
What did you learn?
One of them I learned was that much of my life activities had been devoted to the building of human capital and the critical importance of human capital in the development of societies and nations. And most of my positions, in fact, have had a component of that in them. And I was very surprised to discover that that was one of the major themes of my life careers.
A couple more Michigan State questions for you, Dr. Wharton. Your name will live on here at Michigan State as, of course, the namesake of the Wharton Center. How does that make you feel?
Oh, wonderful, because when that happened, it meant that Michigan State representatives, we were being represented by them permanently there at the campus. And that's a thrill. It really is.
Well, our special guest has been Clifton Wharton Jr., President Emeritus of MSU and author of the new memoir, Privilege and Prejudice, The Life of a Black Pioneer. A reminder that Dr. Wharton returns to Michigan State next Monday evening. He'll join President Luana Simon in a Worldview Lecture Series discussion at the Cobb Great Hall, Wharton Center, of course, about his legacy at MSU and his various other leadership roles. And there will be more about the book as well. I had the honor of shaking your hand back in March of 1976 when I received my diploma over at the auditorium. It was a special moment then, and this has been very special as well. All the best to you, Dr. Wharton.
Well, I'm glad a great Spartan shook my hand and is now interviewing me.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Well, speaking of impressive resumes, musician mandolinist Chris Thiele certainly has one. His solo and collaborative concerts and recordings have earned him 4 Grammy Awards and a MacArthur Grant. On Friday night, he has a concert at Western Michigan University. Current State Scott Pohl recently talked with Chris Thiele about his career and an exciting new project he has coming up in 2016. What's he going to be up to, Scott?
Well, Mark, you've heard of a little public radio show called A Prairie Home Companion, haven't you?
I have.
Hosted by a fellow named Garrison Keillor.
Mm.
Well, Keillor is going to step down next year, and Chris Thiele has been chosen to become the next host of the show. He's performed on the program a number of times. Chris Thiele and I talked about that, but we also talked about that MacArthur Genius Grant. Chris Thiele, welcome to Current State.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to ask you about your 5-year MacArthur Grant. I understand you're about halfway through it. People call it the Genius Grant, and I thought it might be interesting to start off by asking you about how that process works. People hear it as being no strings attached. But is that really so? Are you required to file reports of any sort or tell them what you're doing?
No, absolutely not. It really is no strings attached. But of course, what they don't say is how hot the fire is that one naturally lights under oneself after receiving that thing. You start. I think it becomes a sort of indictment almost. I had no idea I was even being considered. I knew what it was. I have some friends who've been awarded them in the past, and have always thought it was a really cool thing. When I got the call, I thought it was a joke. I thought my bandmates and Punch Brothers were pranking me or something. And when I when this guy Daniel Sokolow finally told me, no, this is, it's not a joke. This is actually, we think you should have this. you know, then all of a sudden you're instantly like, hey, I promise I'm going to do better than I have done so far. I promise I'm going to do something cool. I will. I've always tried to be a hard worker. I love what I do, and I love ending the day knowing a little bit more about music than I started it knowing. And I'd say, yeah, if anything, I got home with sort of an increased drive to try and make something nice for people.
We're speaking with mandolinist Chris Thiele, who has played, of course, with great ensembles like Nickel Creek, the Punch Brothers. He's played with Yo-Yo Ma in a collaboration called the Goat Rodeo Sessions. On Friday night, he'll be at the Dalton Center Recital Hall at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo as part of the Fontana Chamber Arts Music Series. Earlier this year, Chris, you and the Punch Brothers put out a new album called The Phosphorescent Blues. We want to hear a little bit of music from that, and then we'll talk about it. Let's hear Familiarity.
It's all pretend. You love it because you love them. As you explode out of your phones, amen. To make some music of your own, amen. Or you can hate it softly to yourself, alone, amen, amen, amen.
Tell me about this project, The Phosphorescent Blues.
Well, the boys and I, when we sat down in the writing room, which actually ended up being portable. We would go to these various cities that we love in America and hunker down for a week or so and do some writing, do some thinking. The boys and I realized we had all been thinking a lot about the impact that smartphone technology was having on the world. Obviously, I mean, it's having a massive impact. You know, giving us so much in the way of connection with each other, but also depriving us of so many moments, taking us out of so many moments, you know, in the name of connection with maybe people who aren't there. But are we having less truly beautiful moments with the people that are there? And so the record is kind of dives into that, and not that we have any answers, and not that we think that this is just, you know, the devil's technology or anything. I bet you at any point along the way, you know, you have people saying, you know, obviously when it was the personal computer, you know, you've got people saying like, oh, this is going to ruin everything. The television before that, radio, the light bulb, I mean, on back to the wheel. I guarantee there was some caveman sitting next to another caveman going, this is going to ruin everything. And so, I don't think it's that. I do think we have our work cut out for us, just making sure that we use this that we use it and it doesn't use us, honestly. And the record's just kind of an exploration of that thinking.
Chris Thiele, do you have upcoming releases we should be thinking about keeping an eye open for?
Yo-Yo Ma, Edgar Meyer, and I are working on a Bach record together. But then the big project looming for me is assuming the reins of a Prairie Home Companion starting next fall. So I'm going to be working a lot on that.
Well, that's an exciting project, of course. Your first appearance on a Prairie Home Companion in the mid-90s, you were only 15 years old. That's really amazing. Lots of musicians have been heard over the years, of course, on the program, but I'll bet there haven't been that many 15-year-olds on a Prairie Home Companion over the years.
I suppose not. It was such a momentous occasion for me. I flew up there with my mom, and I think it might have been the first gig that I ever flew to, and meeting Garrison. I've listened to Prairie Home Companion since I was aware of being alive. And anyway, if I can be a part of carrying that tradition on and giving people a truly enjoyable 2 hours on Saturdays. I'll be a happy man.
Well, Chris Thiele, as someone who has worked in public radio for 30 years and 30 plus years, and thinking about taking Garrison Keillor's place as host of a Prairie Home Companion, I can only say good luck with that.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with mandolinist Chris Thiele, who'll be in Kalamazoo on Friday night at Western Michigan University as part of the Fontana Chamber Arts Music Series. Information is available at fontanamusic.org. Chris Thiele, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And as you head out to your Halloween parties or neighborhood trick-or-treating, you'll probably see a few Draculas. So in honor of Halloween weekend, our book reviewer Scott Southard reviews the horror novel that inspired countless movies, books, and Halloween costumes.
Welcome to my house. Come freely, go safely, and leave something of the happiness you bring. With those words, Count Dracula has been welcoming readers into his castle in Transylvania for over 100 years now. Dracula was not the first vampire in literature, but he is easily the most important. The Count has flown like a bat out of Bram Stoker's classic novel and into our cultural imagination. The vampires of today's fantasy fiction all owe something to the Dark Count. Yet, when contemporary readers turn to Stoker's original novel, they might be surprised, because, pardon the pun, it is easy for reviewers to take a bite out of this imperfect horror. The Dracula in Bram Stoker's book is not the vampire you might expect. Movies and other pop culture interpretations usually miss the mark when it comes to the novel's central character. Even the 1992 film Bram Stoker's Dracula is not really Bram Stoker's Dracula. The original Dracula is not a romantic hero. He's a monster, driven by his hunger for blood and his uncontrolled lust to take what he wants. There are three things that will surprise contemporary readers when they pick up this classic novel. The first is how little horror there really is in the book. It may seem strange to say it, but the body count is surprisingly low. There's only a few moments of real white-knuckle terror scenes. My favorite one is the sea journey Dracula takes to London. During the trip, he takes out members of the crew, one by one, and you can feel the desperation and fear grow with each new entry in the ship's logs. It's also surprising how little we see of the vampire. While the book is called Dracula, the infamous Count only makes a few appearances in its pages. Yes, he is the focus of all the main characters' discussions, but beyond some conversation with his English broker, Jonathan Harker, he is nothing more than a dark and haunting shadow lurking in the background. He is the mystery to be solved, and then becomes the focus of the hero's hunt for justice. The third, and the most surprising for me during this recent reading, is how religious the novel is. The friends of Dracula's first victim spend the book seeking revenge for their deceased friend. Each member of the team views their work as something spiritual, part of a great battle between good and evil. Honestly, it can get a little heavy-handed. If you have the ability to turn off everything you know about the Count and just experience the book as Stoker intended, it's actually a good story with some interesting high points. For example, the narrative is told through a series of diaries, journals, and letters. This gives us a first-hand insight into all the characters as they discover and experience the horror of Count Dracula's actions. While we go in knowing exactly who Dracula is, the characters have to be convinced of the monster. We expect the fangs. They don't. Dracula by Bram Stoker might not be the thriller you believe it to be. And, like Harker, staying at the doorway of the castle, you have to decide for yourself if you wish to enter or not. Go on. It's Halloween. What do you have to lose? For Current State, this is Scott Southard.
And Scott Southard is the author of the new novel Permanent Spring Showers and A Jane Austen Daydream. You can follow his writing via his blog, The Musings and Artful Blunders of Scott D. Southard, at sdsouthard.com. That's our show for today. Friday on Current State, Amolds, the oldest restaurant in Lansing, closes its doors tomorrow. We'll talk with owner Paul Grusko about the memories he has of growing up in the restaurant and what he has planned. Next, we'll review October's top Michigan political news with Kathleen Gray of the Detroit Free Press and Zach Gorchow of Gongwer News. Plus, our Live Music Friday guest, jazz pianist Eric Smith. He is joined by three other players who are all part of his most recent EP called Hey There, Miss. All are students studying jazz at Michigan State University. We look forward to that. All live here in Studio S. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Melissa Benmark, April Van Buren, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and to Drew Henderson for engineering. Get Current State delivered straight to your smartphone every morning. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter at KAR Current State, on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. Oh, it's Halloween weekend. It's just about here. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.